could be mentioned today. Maybe they do. You're going to have to wait until the very last question. And then that's when I'm going to close my question. And the board is over. I'm very discouraged. I haven't done it with UNT. I start the rest of the people in my class. So, and he was just my idea. Such a line forward up here. Thank you. if you came out against a man, you were fighting a single combat. This idea of single combat is a Greek idea that just the Greek Philistines seem to be strange. The Jews seem to have never heard of it before. And you've got that, you know, your champion, this is my champion, winner take all. What was the Greek idea I had in the Philistines? The Philistines were these people. And but anyway, if you came out with a man came out against you, not properly attired, with proper armor on, glistening, creaking, clanking, that was a great insult. This is why he said to David, come out, well, not because of David's weapon. The sling was not a child's toy. It was not a child's weapon. It was a deadly weapon. 700 out of Benjamin with his foot of hair with the left hand. And it was a exceedingly powerful weapon. Anyway. My point is that the ancient Greeks had engaged in single combat, and it made for great heroes, and it made for great storytelling around the campfire at night. Made for great songs, great literature for Homeric epic poetry. It's a good way to lose a war. go out one at a time. And so they learned by the Greeks, by the historic period, by 750 BC on, the Greeks developed what's called a phalanx. They found that really on the hero business, if you're going to win the battle, you had to stay together. So they were forming these squares, what it came to be is basically the old British square. By the way, you know that in the Revolutionary War, one of the reasons that the British lost in the American woods was that they insisted on finding the old British square. Line up, on the front line shoot, they kneel down, second line load, and then they fire and they kneel down the third line, and they do the load, the third line fires over their head, they kneel down and load, the back line fires over their head. Then they load front lines ready to stand up and shoot again. And shut down like that. A withering fire. And the British use that all through the 19th century in India. They're still using it. I'll believe. And we're just like the American Revolutionary cut of the pieces. It makes a great party. You all stay together, you got in the open. And you know they're going to be eating behind a tree and take them off. That's what they did. They did. They got this idea from the old group, from the Roman legion, beat up from the Greeks, the old phalanx, where you all lined up, and rather than having muskets firing over each other, so they had spears that was front line would have spears, and spears are very seldom thrown. Back in the old period, back in the days of Homeric heroes, the Battle of Troy, they were thrown. It's not there to hang on to. Once you threw it, you missed. All you got was the back. All you got was some idiot the other side throwing back at you. What they did was they were holding on to it. They were thrusting weapons. And it was all they learned to march, even run together instead in unison. But this was the beginning of marching. That's what all the marching was, the traditional marching, whether the military and the bagpipes or the bugles and the drums or anything, was to set a cadence so you could all move together. That's what the drum of the war thinks of. Set a rhythm. And you would all run together. And the front line would have short spears. The longer the back line would have, the line next line would have slightly longer ones. The third one would lay across the shoulder. The third line had even longer ones, so it was just a solid wall of spears coming at you. And they could shift. They could, on a signal, they could all raise the spears up and say, if you were on the back line here, on the edge. All of a sudden, if they shifted, if they trade spears, you would be on the front line. And you go in any direction, a certain signal, and very effective. Romans learned this and developed it in their legion. That's why I said it, that the idea was that you could either have heroes or you have victory. You have that kind of the and the preacher likes to be the hero. But then everybody works together. They had victory and hero. Because the Romans knew this. The Roman general put his son to death. Said his son's a great hero. The Romans didn't need heroes. They need victory. The Roman army was highly polished, they were fighting, and the cavalry was a wing, was an auxiliary force. The main thing was the Roman legion. And what they would do is,
that question, I'm sorry, but I don't know.
Now, did they get those ideas from the Greeks, the one fighting plus the group? The Romans had learned the lesson the Greeks had learned. They learned the phalanx of the square, they would fight together, the line.
C-H-A-L-A-N-A.
Now, the old Greek, the soldier who fought in this was called a hoplite. He was a Latin army. But anyway, But
in the imperial provinces, that is, the provinces administered directly by the emperor, he would keep his private army there, and they would tend to his business. And this is why, when Paul appealed to Caesar, the second he appealed to Caesar, he became the emperor's business. Therefore, it was the Praetorian, therefore he was kept under guard by Caesar's private army, the Praetorian Guard, which is why Paul was guarded by a centurion, or I'm sorry, a member, a soldier in the Praetorian Guard. You got this? Because he appealed to Caesar, any business that Caesar was directly concerned with, his involved the military, the transportation of the prisoners, the Praetorian Guard had this responsibility. So they like a law, this principle of keeping only one third of the army in Rome, two thirds out of the provinces, because the Senate, this is a sort of a trade off, because the Senate didn't like having too many soldiers responsible to the emperor in Rome, because the emperor had a way of deciding to purge the Senate anytime they didn't agree with what the Senate said. And it was kind of a matter of keeping a balance of power. Now, the Praetorian Guard was ideal service. For instance, in the Praetorian Guard, it was the prestige regiment. The term of service was 16 years rather than 20 years. It's a good term of duty. You got that? You only committed yourself for 16 years, rather than 20. They were the best paid. They were higher paid than the other elements in the Roman army, and they seldom fought. They paraded a lot. They were sort of a show, kind of like an honor guard in some ways. You know, lots of parades, lots of stick polish. Not very much fighting. That is, there was a dirty job. It had been on slavery boats. Or there was a border conflict out in the field, you know, way ahead of something like this. Dirty job, marked long and hard, and put down some barbarians. You didn't come to that. You sent some other regiments like them become cannon fodder. But it was a great honor being in the Praetorian Guard. Well, anyway, a legion was, what does legion mean in Latin? Very young. Thousand. Yeah. Roman numerals is L. You know, this is what, in L, that means, wait a minute, legion is, I'm sorry. Yeah, at least it's 1,000, it's not good to say. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm sorry, yeah. I'm trying to see, you know, the legion is 1,000, because that's not hell, normally indicate 1,000 soldiers, a unit of 1,000. However, none of the legions ever had 1,000 soldiers. By Trajan's time, they had roughly a little over 500. And Caesar, Augustus' time, probably 600. Why? Well, because at any given time, you could have a number who would be.
Soldier, you know, in the aristocracy. Or it might mean every man is amateur. because many of these men were very good and won great battles. But many of these, but you see, just because a man is born to the rest of the county doesn't mean he makes a good commanding officer. There are a lot of terrible ones, and Rome lost a lot of battles that he'd not have lost simply because of the poor leadership. Because they had to put a man here, a man in senatorial rank, to get him a legion, and maybe he's a good officer, maybe he is. And there were a lot of bad ones. So it kind of balanced out. There were six military tribunes under this legate. These tribunes were either senatorial rank or equestrian rank. Let's talk about the equestrian rank. The equestrians were like a second class aristocracy. The equestrians were not a senatorial rank, but they were above the common everyday citizen. Originally, what does equus mean in Latin? Horse. Originally, the equestrian was a man who had enough money that when in time of war, and keep in mind, the spirit of old Rome, if you had money, you served at your own expense, a public servant in the real sense of the word. In the old system, like the Republic, the question is, here's a man who had enough money to provide himself with a horse and with armor and with weapons, and therefore he would be in the cavalry if he did so, and he was a knight. You find this carried on in the Middle Ages. He was a knight, a horse soldier. Now later on, this became sort of an honorary title. And you see something like this when you see on a 4th of July parade or a Christmas parade, you have fellows who will, like in the, well, we have it here, but not we have the Sheriff Mounted Patrol. He's not George of the Sheriff Department, which means that they put on the Sheriff's deputy uniform and guns and rode horses. They did this every time there was a parade, and that was it. You know, they didn't do any real business, real law business. It was simply an honorary, they thought it was an honorary thing. And like last time, you know, they got the horses around the parade, and they put their spear in. They kind of later on, by the first century, the equestrian ranked man, anybody who had enough money to provide this kind of wealth, whether they did so or not. And it had nothing to do with direct military activity, but it was a rank in society, and I'll talk about it later, but you had so much money, and you could wear a gold ring, and they think of James chapter 1 about a man who enters the assembly with a gold ring, because of the equestrian rank. This was the citizen, the honored citizen, who was above the average citizen, but below the senatorial rank, the equestrian. Now, that is sort of a second class nobility. And these tribunes had either the senatorial rank or an equestrian rank. And there were six of those per legion. And then, under them, you had the legate. He was the chief officer of senatorial rank. And under them he had six tribunes, but this is per legion now. They were the senatorial rank or equestrian rank. The question is spelled E-U-E-S-T-R-I-A-N. Then under them, the individual units of the legion came the centurion. Over 100. A man over 100. Again, there was never a 100 men. Remember the centurion said to Jesus, I say to my man, to one man go, and he goes, to another man come, and he comes. All you have to do is speak the word, and it's legal, or be obedient to you. And the centurion were the backbone of the army. They were like the modern staff sergeants in the army. That is, when the army actually did business, they were the ones who were the backbone of the army.
If you really, legions were normally running 500 to 600, and you had 6 pigeons, you'd have as many centurions as you had pigeons, or you'd have more.
No, you'd have, it was supposed to be 1,000. You'd have 6 tribunes over them, but they were divided, the league was divided in 10 groups of 100, ideal, on paper, but they never had that many. If a centurion was over 60, he was doing well. So they were always losing,
So they sent centurions.
Yes. Centurion could come from probably be the average, maybe be a Roman citizen, but he would not be at the equestrian rank or a senatorial rank. You got that? He's a common everyday citizen. Now, the average soldier in originally was a citizen too. However, by the time of Augustus, you had the average, the common soldiers would be anybody. You would have Roman legions, which would be made up of all Roman citizens. You would have legions that would have Roman officers, that have Numidians, have Greeks. The Greeks were great fighters, especially Greek mercenaries. You have Greeks. For instance, most of the soldiers in the Roman army who patrolled Judea in the days of Jesus were Samaritans, according to Josephus. Jews wouldn't serve in the army. They'd die. They wouldn't serve in the army. They'd fight against Rome, but they would not march under the eagle. So, while the officers were Romans, most of the soldiers in the Roman army, when Jesus was in Palestine in the first century, were Samaritans. Not all of them. They were Greek and Samaritans.
Oh,
thank you. They were paid. That didn't mean they volunteered. Yeah.
How did Paul become a Roman citizen?
He was born to it. Either his father or his grandfather. Achieved it. We're not worried about achieving it. There's a number of ways, but serving in great honor in the government some way, or marrying a citizen. Okay, got this now? When a centurion was promoted, he was always moved to a different area. We had to think how many modern days. He was always moved to a different area. When a centurion was promoted, he was always moved to a different area. That is, he would always be. The Romans followed this policy that when you became an officer, see, a centurion was like a staff sergeant. If you became an officer, the man who had to decide who went into battle, the Romans learned what our military knows is. The best is the officers do not, are not on familiar terms with the enlisted men. Why is that? Yeah, they, if you know these fellows, this outfit maybe 4 or 5 year old Lincoln buddies, so you may decide to send somebody else into the heat of the battle. Or, if you didn't come in decisive, but it's best, when the officer has to make this whole hard decision, that he knows it's going to cost a lot. It's a long time ago. The officer doesn't know he's going to do it. He makes better decisions. Yeah, same way now. So, if we've all worked through the military, we've got the officers over here, and the ordinary soldiers over here. There's very good reason for that. Well, anyway, so the centurion was promoted, you see, he had a bunch of guys under him, his 100 or 60. 7,900 men he had, and they had been through hell together. He had a 10th of the legion. If he was promoted, then what might he do?
Take his
men
with him?
Yeah.
Or we take his men with him?
No.
He'd send the other.
Yeah, he'd pick some other. Send other 100 to do the dirty work, to protect his. So when he was promoted, he had moved another legion, so he would not know the men. I still done today, by the way. Anyway, the centurion was paid 15 times as much as an ordinary soldier. Now, the ordinary soldier, the line man, he was not the one below the centurion, was, I'm sad to say, for the most part, a bum. He was a killer. He probably had no education. Probably very poor. Very often they would go in the army to do the army or jail. And by the way, some of the toughest fighting outfits in the world have ever known have been made up primarily of criminals. But the most famous one is which?
Freshborn Legion.
Men who had nothing to get, nothing to lose. And they were, and by the way, you find quite a few times when you find men who speak in military career consoles tend to be men who are not the most global. Many, many, many exceptions. But the average soldier tended to be, let's say, if you live that long, you know, if you've been there 5 or 6 years, he was tough. And these men were tough. They did amazing things. Yes. You're probably not going to need them all along. You will volunteer on it. Tend to find, you often find fellows. Now, in wartime, when they just draft everybody, it's not like that. But very often in peacetime, you tend to find fellows in the military who are, you carry them in the infantry. Very often, who have, are losers in peacetime. That is, they didn't qualify for any type of school, or they didn't want to, or they can't get promoted because they keep getting drunk, you know, get trapped in the rank. Now, there are many exceptions. I mean, there are many exceptions. But a peacetime army tends to be very moral. And because you tend to find fellows who get the pay as low, they're not maybe the limited. Now, there are very many exceptions to this. It's certainly true back then. But you just wouldn't. Nobody wanted them around. And again, the black soldier, everybody wants them around because war, something was fighting to be done. When the fight's over, nobody wants them around. It's a tough situation. But anyway, and so it was very low, but the centurion was paid 15 times as much as the ordinary soldier, 5,000 denarii a year. Don't worry about that. And, the five top centurions in a legion, there would be 10 centurions in a legion, the five top were paid 10,000. You could move up in rank and considerable money. Now, therefore, you find the centurion that you meet in the New Testament. Was the centurion's house? He had a household, apparently had some wealth. He was a respected citizen. Number one centurion built a synagogue for the Jews. He was much loved of the Jews. These tend to be men who were noble, very often were men who were noble, had money, were respected in the community. So the highest paid centurion was called the Primus Pilatus, or First Spear. That's my first violin in the order. And if he was had to get when he had his an honor, don't you have an honor was in the military, don't you have somebody in an honor position, you know, when you march in formation, carries the flag?
That's true. Oh, the guide on.
Yeah. Kind of like this. He was a first centurion. His 100 were the first, the best. He was called the First Spear. And he was the highest paid of all. He went from First Spear up to becoming a tribune. So he went up to become a tribune.
Now, this interesting to you?
I think it's kind of like Texas flavor of some of these men who you read about in the Testament. And, you see, you find military metaphor and simile. Paul says, any man that's going the army does not get involved, tell Timothy, does not get involved in the care of this world, because if you go in the army, you're in. You've got to fight for your life. And Paul talks about putting on the shield of faith and the helmet of righteousness, taking the sword of the Spirit, the sword of God. And he had military metaphor as well, similar in the Testament reference. One more thing, the soldiers had to buy their own food and clothes out of their salary. They received what was called a solarium, or a salt ration. They were paid. They received money, but they had to buy their own food and clothes. But they received a salt ration. Salt was very valuable in the ancient world. And by the way, there's a very old term we borrowed from the Romans, which is, he's not worth his, any man worth his salt. And a soldier was, you know, they didn't say this about a soldier, he was, he couldn't depend on, you know, worth his salt. It's his salt ration, it was very convenient. You also get wine rations, sometimes, in some places. Okay? That's the basic structure of the Roman army. Now, one more thing. And this is interesting, I think. The Romans, the Latin word for camp, because I had no idea. castra. Castra is the Latin word for king. Castrum is the... Now, and many, I'll say this to the benefit, that many sites in Western Europe, these cities, were originally Roman military camps, and cities grew up around them. And you see this in England, for instance. You have almost every other town of England seems like history. Is Chester, you know, Lang is you have Worcester, Saul, and Lancaster, and Chichester, and all these, any other in England, Winchester. These are the Chester, at the end of the word, with the anglicized form of Costa. Anytime you find these cities with that Chester or Costa, Lancaster, at the end, that's a city that was grouped in the Roman military camp. They were named some so-and-so camp. And the name stuck. That's true. Now, while we're talking about this, let me talk about the free citizens, because this is involved, soldiers. The free citizens, this is an extra thing in your outline. You want to make it free, Roman numeral 3A or something, if you want to read your piece, don't worry about it. I didn't stick this in. This is important to us because Paul was a citizen of Rome. Now, the citizens, the free citizens, are sometimes called the third estate. There was a great number of citizens by the first century in the world of the New Testament, which were neither rich nor poor, but were simply citizens. Now, as Rome began to expand in the period, in the centuries, mainly the century before our period, the life of the Republic. Remember I said that Rome originally expanded by fighting really defensive wars, and then simply administering the conquered territory. And by this time, Spain had fought Carthage, the Punic Wars. The term Punic is a cognate to the word Phoenician. P-N-C, Phoenician means Punic. And the Carthaginians were Phoenician people. In fact, Dido, the founder of Tyre, the woman, Tyre, tradition says, and it's probably true, was related to Jezebel, Ahab's wife, the Phoenicians. But they had, in the process of conquering this section of the world, they had acquired slaves. We're going to talk about slavery later, the sources of slavery, but let me talk here about the fact that this had a profound effect upon the citizens, and one of the reasons why the economy was in chaos, and one of the reasons why Augustus was so concerned about what we would call moral reform. You see, slaves became numerous. And according to the law of supply and demand, anything which becomes numerous becomes cheap, relatively so. A slave is not cheap, it would be fed. It became relatively cheap. And what happened was that with the influx of slavery, it became possible for the wealthier citizens, mainly those of senatorial rank, to acquire estates and to operate them with slave labor. Now, what can you do if you have like a plantation and it's, or an estate in a lot where you sort of farm, maybe several hundred acres, and it's worked by slaves? What does that mean? What does it mean as far as the cost of production? It goes down. You can afford to sell your grain much cheaper. And one of the things that happened with it, probably, with the victory, they acquired many of the prisoners of war, they acquired the rich landowners, acquired many slaves, and we're talking about slavery itself later on, but it tended to drive a small farmer citizen out of business. And he had to sell his grain when prices were down and buy seed when prices were up. Add to this was the fact that it was very common for them to for a man to go to war, a citizen, to leave his farm, in the keeping of paid servants or members of the family, to go to war, and sometimes be gone 4, 5, or 6 years. And very often,
This is in the generation before Augustus, before Julius Caesar. It was a common thing. I mean, it happened. It was a widespread thing that a man under these severe economic conditions, where he's competing with slave labor, where it's costing him more for grain and he's getting less and less for it, he would go to war and be gone 4 or 5 years and come back, and for these reasons and perhaps some other reasons, poor management, whatever, his farm would have been, he would have lost his farm. Thousands and thousands have experienced this. So here he was, destitute. He lost his farm, he didn't reap the field. And also, what happened was that they would tend to borrow money to plant the crops and have to mortgage their farm. They had mortgages, before he could find his farm, had been foreclosed. And this happened over a long period. In fact, there were two brothers, Gracchi, G-R-A-C-C-H-I, don't worry about this, but this is before our period. The name was Gracchian Reforms, which is what produced the dole. The Gracchi, these senators, back in the Republic, they realized that here were men who had gone out and fought, only to come back and find that their farms, that they lost their farms, lost the family, that they were citizens now. And they were starving. And so they were the ones who started the welfare state. Said the state owes these men this. We ain't been there. They must be fair. And then it expanded to all citizens were fair, just about all. And so there was, by the time of the first century, by our period, Rome, especially the city of Rome, but many major cities in the Roman Empire, the major cities, were filled with free citizens who were destitute. There were other reasons, but this was one of the primary reasons. Now, this was the mob, the famous mob. And the mob had to be cared for. Now, you have to do two things to a mob. Mobs are very dangerous things. These people were not educated. They were culturally very low. They depended upon the state for their dole, lived off the state, and they were idle. And they were resentful because many slaves, we're going to see later, were better off than they were. It's very common to find slaves who were better off than citizens. And you see, and a part of these people could not work. Many of them would not work. Why? They were citizens of Rome. It's a big thing to be a citizen. Remember, Paul could claim his citizenship and be honored because of it? The very fact he was a citizen. Well, if you were a citizen, you'd starve very often before you'd go out and do a slave's work. This is the summer generation. Maybe you'd own slaves. They had fed the pigs. Were you going to do it? Well, I'd starve first. Human pride. And they were just lazy. So you had in the major cities, especially Rome, you had the mob, thousands and thousands of citizens who were on the welfare, who were vulgar, uncultured, vicious, unpredictable, and resentful because of the circumstance, selfish, and you see, and this was the reason for the Roman games, the gladiatorial contest, the shows. What was the cry? Bread and services. Give them food, keep them quiet, and entertain them to keep them from overthrowing the government. But entertain them had to interesting. George Orwell's 1984. He had the common people in this pathetic novel, and the government had to feed them, but to keep them entertained, they used pornography. And the Romans did exactly the same thing. And this is why, from Augustus' age on, the games had to be more and more vicious. There'd be more and more deaths. Be more and more vulgar. Oh, and not just the games, the plagues were very common in the first century, for instance, had Roman plagues where they would have explicit, have sex acts on stage. The constant part of the Orlando now. And they would have the most perverted, vicious thing you could possibly imagine. Because the people kept crying for more. It's pornography. It was pornography in a way. It would show humans having sexual intercourse with animals. This was staged. It would have animals. This is how the Christians were used. To placate and give somebody, this is very convenient, needed somebody anyway. The worst criminal, they were, you know, the mob, they made the lies in putting a fifty fellows in the down there and putting their hungry lions in on them. Everybody had a great fun. Or watching the gladiatorial contest. Strong killing the weak. And you see, the nature of this thing, pretty soon people get bored with it. They have to have something more vicious, more sadistic, more perverted, more killing, more blood, more sex. And it all began, you see, it was this period that we're talking about. It was under full steam to placate the mob of citizens. And the church certainly fell victim to this. This is very important to the history of the church. Anyway, Tom, I go back to your question. I'm sorry.
No, it's like Augustus is still ruling at this time?
See, what he did, he tried to reform this. I'm talking about something that they're beating up in this. He limited the goal. The goal was getting a bread to 200,000. He tried to stop it. He tried to straighten the thing up as best he could. Very little success. I'm trying to show the condition that created this, some of the conditions. Y'all have to follow me? They're about two this time. For instance, back in the day, the Punic War, these lost the family estates. Slavery, one of the things that really killed the Roman Empire was slavery. It demoralized the people. For instance, you find this still in the South. It's a part of the Southern culture that a white man, either is a man of leisure or appears or claims to be. We're getting away from this now. This is in part of the same culture. Why? See, you realize in the Civil War, the war between the states, that less than one white man, white Southerner, out of 100 actually had slaves. There weren't very many people owned slaves. You just count up. The vast majority of the white Southerners who died in the Southern cause never owned slaves. Dying. But you see, a part of the justification was, part of their concern was, that there was always somebody beneath them. I'm above somebody. And therefore, as long as I'm white, you see, there was somebody beneath me. This was the old Roman. As long as he's a citizen, there's somebody beneath him on the social scale. Everybody else wants to be there to somebody else. So it produced. This was. I'm going a little long now. This is one of the reasons that the empire was falling. The republic crumbled. The Caesar was trying to put it together. And Augustus was trying to put it together. Society was falling apart. What was your question? Yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to pick on the South because everybody's like this. You have. It's interesting that North was very self-righteous about slavery. So that's one because they tried to do work. So it's not a matter of leaping off, it's not a reason for that. It's on human nature. It's very demoralizing. Well, I don't know what I'm trying to try to make of it, but for instance, the old Southern aristocracy, they had a cult of leisure. What did a woman do? The idea of Southern Belle is she was really the perfect lady. Did not know how to cook. Did not dress herself. Spent her time painting china, writing and reciting bad poetry, patterned after Sir Walter Scott, playing the piano, going to tea parties, and she was expected to paint at least three times a day. You got the bakers. She was swimming, you know. And as part of it, and the Southern lady probably the toughest character that ever came down the pipe. But she wasn't supposed to act like that. she's supposed to invite Jamie in. And the one thing she would never ever have is a suntan. As white as possible. They put powder on them to appear as white as possible. Why? You say, who got a suntan? Somebody worked out in the sun. The old Southern Belle, that which was totally useless, or supposed to be, if you were the glasses of Captain Bobby, that was the image. And, see, this is the Romans. See, this is very demoralizing. It's interesting, and we have, and most of the American idea is, which was the Calvinistic idea really helped us in this, is that they can do the work. A man, we respect a man, will go out and do his part, and carry his share of the load. And my father-in-law said, any man doesn't ever hurt you, he doesn't carry his share of the load. but you see that this is a very different end. Okay, well,
citizens, whether or not to have an ostracism. And
If 6,000 voted yes, then they would have the ostracism. They would apply. You would, at this voting time, take a piece of an ostracar or a broken piece of pottery. You would write the name of the man, the Athenian citizen that you wanted out of town. And the man who got the most votes had to leave town for 10 years. It was an honorable exile. That is, but what this wasn't was a system of checks and balances. In a man who was getting too powerful. I mean, you know, you didn't hate the man, they want to kill him. Rather than have a revolution, you know, to get him out. They were ostracized. Convincing Mr. who started this later on, the ostracized him. But, well, this is good. This doesn't make sense. Say, better than war, isn't it? Think about what that would say when we're in Iran now. They simply dedicated this constitution. Enough people wanted to have a vote, and they had to leave town. And it just, you know, wasn't a criminal. We had to stay out of the country 10 years.
Charles would be there.
Yeah, he'd be gone. Good. Wouldn't save a lot of killing. Well, the Romans had this. That is, if a man were a political criminal, that is, he hadn't stolen anything or killed anybody, but he held political views that were dangerous, they'd simply banish him. They'd get out of town. Stay out. Now, but what they would do is they would... Let's say either beat a man or put him to death or fine him or take his property or a combination thereof or banish him. Then they would do is put him in a cell and feed him and hold him the rest of his life. You know, and the only time they kept him in jail, for the most part, there was some exception, but the only time they kept him in jail was when they were awaiting trial, then they had to pay for it themselves. Or if they were nobility. And they were sort of there for safekeeping. For instance, Herod, Agrippa, was a good friend of the Emperor Caligula. Later on, they tested Herod. We'll get to that, but we'll mention it again. But Herod Agrippa was put in jail because he fell out of favor with the Claudius. But he was a good friend of Caligula. And when Claudius died, Herod got out, and Caligula gave him a set of gold chains to commemorate, to replace the metal chains, again to wear always in prison. That's an exception. A common man would not be put in solid. They would have sentenced him 20 years. And they might sentence him to the, but the criminal, they became, in fact, what if it was a bad crime or a very dangerous man, the man became in effect a slave. And he might be sent, it was the criminals or the runaways or the dangerous ones that were sent to the galleys, to the salt mines, when they would be worked there. The life expectancy was short. There's something similar to this in American slavery. Not only American slavery, but one of the most vicious kinds of slavery the world has ever known. As the center of the South economy moved from the eastern, the Carolinas and Virginia, the tobacco aristocracy, as this ran out, and it developed in the mid-South, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, cotton became cane, and cane, sugar cane, and slave trade became profitable, and slaves were bought and sold and moved to the mid-South. But in Kentucky and Tennessee and Missouri, parts of Missouri, and some of the northern parts, even Georgia, if a slave acted up, they would, you know, he tried to run away or stole something or didn't cooperate. The threat always hung over his head, he would be sold down the river. By that, they meant it would be sent, they literally went down the river, down to Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, to become a field hand in one of the large plantations where they would be worked, where their life was very miserable, sometimes very short. We have this in our language, by the way. He sold me down the river. This was the threat. If you don't behave, I'll sell you down the river. You didn't get a good price for a strong field hand. He'd be down there, and he would be put in barracks, you know, separate from his family. He probably worked very hard under taskmasters in his huge plantations. Well, the threat in the ancient world was you go to the galleys, and you go to the salt mines, the copper mines, the silver mines. And so there was this very abject kind of slavery. But that was not the majority of slavery. On the other end of the spectrum,
Well, let's count it there. Let's move up a little bit. You would have the farm slave, or the household slave, or the menial. This is a person who would work, you know, in the out in the fields or in the kitchen. And this was a little better kind of slavery. Most of American slavery was like this, the field hand. Above that, you would have what you might call the sometimes the one job slave, and we're going to talk about this in a minute, come back to this in a second, but the slave who had especially they like Greek, they often used Greek slaves, the Romans did, to educate as school teachers, to educate their tutors, to educate their children, or as bookkeepers. These were people who lived pretty fair lives. They were well fed, well dressed, they had jobs and responsibility, and very often became, for all practical purposes, a part of the family. Trusted businessmen, became stewards, skilled. Now, then there was one other level of slave, which was a minority, but which was common, but numerically was not a minority, and that is the slave who became exceedingly wealthy and powerful. Many slaves became, this is a strange phenomenon, there are many slaves that all wrote themselves on slaves. These would often buy their freedom. We'll talk about freedom a little bit later on, too. But these were slaves who had become applied themselves and become wealthy. Their owners had permitted them to, these were civilized people very often, depending on who it was, would permit them to have their own money. Very often they would have their own house, their own family. They would, you know, to just look at them, they would look like very wealthy members of society, very respected. You know, they'd walk down the street, respect people, would talk to them, except that they were owned by somebody else. They were slaves. Many of these, they would buy their freedom. But you have, I kind of divided roughly into four classifications, and then there would be shades of just run together as you cannot, you know, these clear distinctions of the degrees in between these classifications. So I say this because we think of a slave, we can't just think of one human condition. Now, what was the source of these slaves? Let me back up again. Say one more word about the background of slavery. To the ancient world, slavery was a way of life. And they could not conceive of life without it. Now, that is when that one person could actually become the property of another person. Often, critics of the New Testament will condemn the New Testament apostles and prophets because they, in turn, did not condemn the institution of slavery. Now, the old Southern aristocracy used to try to point out that the scriptures condone slavery. Well, that's not quite true either. The Old Testament recognized slavery and set up strict conditions for the treatment of slaves. But often, the slave of the Old Testament was very often what we would call an indentured servant. That is, he was not simply a piece of chattel or a piece of property. His status was slightly higher than he was sort of a bondman. That is, someone who had put himself into a legal situation where they were subserving somebody or technically a slave, like they were slaves. What Paul does, and we see this in the first of his writings, for instance, in the small personal letter to Philemon, Paul says, to slaves, you obey your masters. If he says to masters, you remember that this man, the slave, if he's a Christian, is your brother. Now this in effect, in the long run, did destroy slavery in the Roman Empire when it became, quote, Christian. But Paul did not say offhand that slavery is an evil institution because the scriptures recognize the fact that the focus of Christianity is not to make a man politically or socially, but to make him free from his sins. And that and he said, the master, remember you also have a master. Remember this slave is your brother. I remember that you also have a master. And so Paul sought to mitigate it as much as he could. And eventually Christianity, by inference, or that, I'm sorry, by implication, did destroy slavery in Western Europe. That is, the implication of it. Now, if he said, if it became a the purpose of the church was not to revolutionize Roman society, that was a friend's benefit. It isn't today. It was to deal with a man's personal relationship to God. And, but it did, by implication, realize that if a man is my brother, then if I follow this, if I accept all that this implies, then he cannot be my property. But Paul does not say to slaves, overthrow your masters, you know. He does not say to masters, free your slaves. He says, remember that you have a master and free your brothers. Following? Just by implication, that's what they do. Destroy slavery. Okay, what is the what were the sources of slaves under Jesus or under Roman Nero 4? Well, there were the prisoners of war, number one, of course, which made up the majority of slaves in the days of the Republic. Later on, there were those who were kidnapped. That is, under this, you would include armies would just often go in and take women and children, or that is, they just simply didn't take soldiers as prisoners of war, but they would often just kidnap them. And slave dealers all throughout the Roman world would often just go in and take people. Now, that became illegal, but many slaves would be kidnapped. Then there were criminals, I've already mentioned this. You'd have prisoners of war, you'd have those who were kidnapped. You would have criminals, that is, those who had committed a crime and had been put into slavery by the state. Then there were debt slaves. Very common. A man would go into debt and he would have to sell himself or members of his family into somebody else's service to pay a debt. Or the state would sell him into debt. I'm sorry, sell him into slavery to pay a debt. Prisoners of war, those kidnapped, they're criminals, they're debtors. By the first century, however, a great number of the slaves, perhaps most of them, we can't no way of knowing, were in slavery because they were children of slaves. But their parents had either been prisoners of war or kidnapped or debt slaves or criminals. But now they were born into it. Born into slavery. Sometimes second and third generations. But they, you follow me? They themselves were not prisoners of war. They themselves had never been sold into slavery to resolve the debt that they were born of the parents of grandparents had.
They didn't breed them?
Yes, they did, sometimes. Now, for instance, get back to war prisoners, back in the days of when the fight was going on,
to show you that, you know, this, let's say, how it's really expanded in the early days. Remember I thought that the Romans expanded in this period preceding our New Testament times, back in the days of the second century before this, and the second century before this period. Remember I talked about as the Romans expanding and gradually gaining control of this area, north of Greece, called Epirus. For instance, when they defeated Epirus, they took into slavery, this is the second century BC now, 250,000 slaves. 150,000 of these were the entire male population of Epirus. But when they conquered this land, they said, took all the men, the entire male population, instead of 150,000, over to slavery.
So they took those slaves like that. They were property of the government, and then they sold them, or you could.
Yeah, they sold them. Don't sell them to raise money, fight the war. To sell them to farmers. I know these. Now, and also there was a great influx of Greek slaves. The Romans not Greek slaves because they tend to be cultured, educated. The Romans had a love-hate relationship with the Greeks. They hated the Greeks. The Greeks were a funny people.
The Greeks, as I said, were extreme individualists. Many of them, they were very proud of their culture, their literary culture. The Romans borrowed their philosophy, their literature, their drama from the Greeks. Even the best Roman literature was simply Latinized Greek literature. They even translated the Greek plays. A good when the Romans began to get serious about education, they had to study Homer. And they studied. So the Romans wrote business manuals, but they didn't write poetry. And they borrowed their poetry, they borrowed their religion, really.
And what was
Rome
like before
they started Rome? As I said before, it was a hard-headed, business-like, warrior class, commercial. They were not dreamers, they were pragmatists. Hard-headed businessmen. Stern soldier, not the poet. Now the Greeks, on the other hand, they're high culture, they're proud, they're arrogant about it. And as far as knowing how to run a, as far as politics was concerned, they were total failures. And Alexander the Great, I say, his empire lasted, didn't last as long as his funeral. And because he didn't have an empire. Well, that's your real great song. And the Romans, for instance, hated the Greeks because the Greeks were a part where homosexuality was a way of life among the Greeks. The Romans hated that. The Greeks, for instance, much of the statuary of ancient Greece was nude statuary, it was male statuary. Whereas the ancient old Romans, they thought it was a great shame for a man to even take a bath at this time. His nudity was very much looked down upon by the ancient. Now, by the first century, they were beginning to accept it. Homosexuality was becoming a problem. But for many reasons, the Romans hated the Greeks. For some reasons, they respected them. They borrowed their literature. Sort of a love-hate relationship. Now, many Romans became exceedingly rich in the old aristocracy. We read, for instance, the Pliny the Younger. And we have a letter from Pliny the Younger, which is seen from the governor of Bithynia over here. And he writes and tells about the persecution of Christians. Pliny had 500 slaves.
A lot of slaves.
We read of some who had as many as 4,000 slaves. Plato, way back in the 5th century of Greece, had said, quote, slaves are a troublesome piece of goods. They really were. Slavery, by the way, while it has been an economic boon for obvious reasons, it's not the only thing. Slavery has always been as much a problem for the slave owner as it is for the slave. It was in America. Do you know that before the discovery, before the introduction of cotton and cane, sugar cane, that the South came within one or two votes of eradicating slavery. Legally. Simply because it was too expensive. And it was only the cotton that needed to pay again. That's where it was revived. It almost died out in the South. And in America, you see, slavery made, the institution of slavery made life miserable for the slave owners. For instance, there had to be, it was very expensive, and there had to be the American, white plantation owner, the slave owner, especially those up in the deep south, especially those on the line of the slave, lived in constant fear of his slaves. And as a result, for instance, they never allowed, whenever slaves ran away, they never allowed his fact to be published in the newspapers. And whenever a slave revolted and killed someone in town, killed his master, his fact was never published in the newspapers. It was, historians have a tough time doing it because one of the main sources of historical documentation are ancient Roman newspapers. They simply would not print them. And they tried to, part of this, they tried to create the illusion of the slave as this happy, you know, fellow scratch-located southern student who was refused flags, for example, Massa, looking at happy. It was an absolute lie. Hundreds and hundreds of white people were killed as slaves, but they were just, nobody ever knew about it except the immediate Hungarian. They never published it. Never did newspapers. Why? They didn't want, slaves elsewhere to find out. And for instance, slaves, when they were moved, would never tell where they were. They tried to destroy all points of reference for slaves. They didn't want them to know which it was north, south, east, or west. They did not want them to know where the next town was, you know, or how far it was, say, to the north. They tried to destroy all sense of direction because this would hinder them in running, or would hinder them in uniting. In together, communications. Since many slaves, since the Mississippi took off headed north, and they thought north was the 2-day walk over the hill.
Probably one where America got the first idea of slavery in Britain or somewhere, right there.
It was slavery in Great Britain, where it was America.
That's one where I got the idea from.
Now, the British institution before invaded colonial America. For instance, if the slave in America, the white slaver, for instance, always tried to create a fear of water in the slaves. A stall of water, you'll drown, or the alligators will get you. Because if you can get into your first afraid of water, then every river was a barrier that you would be afraid to swim for. They systematically created this fear. In many states, it was illegal for a slave to learn how to read. Why? Anything to isolate them, to keep them separated, and to keep them there. They were afraid to run away or to get together. I didn't know how. But he said this took a lot of pressure upon the white man because the white slave owner lived in constant fear of the slave. He had very good reason to. Nobody really knows how many slaves did run away or how many revolted and killed their masters. Far more than anybody ever dreamed, because it was always denied. And this myth, finally, this illusion of Stephen Foster wrote way down upon the Swanee River, it's summer, the darkies are gay. Perfectly happy to do that. Absolutely lie. But you had to create this illusion. And then you want everybody else to think, they want everybody to think everybody else is happy, because it was just like sitting on a powder keg. You sit on a powder keg, it's a huge money, there's no fun. And the white man found it. So it's always been this way. Slavery has always been as much trouble, almost the kind of trouble. It's always been just about as much trouble for the slave owner as for the slave. Now, for instance, I mentioned Spartacus yesterday. In AD or BC 73-71 BC, this was the generation before our period. Spartacus led an army of 20,000 ex-slaves, gladiators, and criminals in a revolt. And the Romans had a terrible time putting them down. And they made their headquarters on the slopes of the famous Mount Vesuvius, the ancient volcano. Where they hid out. Took a great, and Pompey, who was involved in the murder of Caesar, he became famous because he put down the slave revolt. And we captured about 30,000 of them. I said 20,000, but he had 200,000 slaves revolted. That's a lot.
Yeah. What was the main thing?
Spartacus was a movie made of this. Now, so, it's always been so. Any questions on that?
What's the name of the place you're going to say for?
Mount Vesuvius.
You can't run it.
200,000. when we enslaved, very often runaways, very common. And of course, the most famous runaway slave, as far as we know, of our period is who? over the first century. Onesimus ran away, and Paul wrote this first letter to Philemon, by him accepted back. Well, you see, so this is very much in the first book of the background of the New Testament study. And by the way, you see, what Onesimus did was Paul ran into Onesimus. Or Onesimus ran to Paul, or they looked him up. And they don't know, but but I see the law was if a slave ran away, you'd have an F for fugitive branded into his forehead, or he'd put to death for the capital crime to run away. And so, by the way, because of this, I'll show you how this is important. You're going to be glad you came today. Maybe we did so. Because of the slave law that a man was, that once a slave ran away, anybody who's ever caught would be branded and put to death. Very serious. That's the reason why the book of Ephesians and the New Testament is named Ephesians. I'll tell you what. See, what happened was that Onesimus found Paul and wrote, and Paul sent him back. But, and he sent him back, he carried three letters with him. He carried a letter to the church of Colossae, because he was from Colossae, Philemon. He was a leader in the, the leader of the church at Colossae. So he carried in his possession, when Paul sent him back, he carried three letters. He carried the Colossian letter. He carried Philemon, his personal letter, to his master. And he carried what we call the book of Ephesians with him. But it wasn't sent to the church of Ephesus. It's certainly the letter. In this valley, there was like a horseshoe. It's called the old Roman postal here in the Lycus Valley. There were seven major cities, and these seven are the seven famous seven churches of Asia. And the book of Ephesians was written initially to the same churches that the book of Revelation was written to. And if you look at the book of Revelation, you find that the seven churches are listed in the order that they come on this road. If you start up here, look at the turn over to the book of Revelation. The seven churches, the church at Ephesus, right? First one. So if you start in Ephesus, by the way, start in Ephesus, which is the most important city, and you go kind of this horseshoe, this circle, these seven cities, Smyrna, Sardis, Thyatira, Pergamum, Philadelphia, I'm down to Laodicea, you get, about, and what I'm saying is that the way the churches are listed in the book of Revelation are the orders that come on that road if you start at Ephesus and go down to Laodicea. It's the minority, spoke to one, who spoke to the other. Now you get some of these Jake Lake fundamentals, wildcat prophecy, that. Seven ages of the church, more than the Odyssey age now, than the Philadelphia age.
2017.
You know, you're going to come across that. And dispensationalists do that a lot, just challenging that kind of thing. But a piece of pure, bona fide government, that's a great age, isn't it? Those seven churches are listed in that order, according to Revelation. Not because.